Hi again. This is David Ellis, editor of Health Futures Digest. We digest so you don't get indigestion. You can access this podcast and the written version of it at hfd.dmc.org. Our topic this month of February in the year 2010 is bionic implants and ways to connect them to our nervous system. In a larger sense, though, our topic is about the dawn of the age of Superman and Superwoman. We might draw the line at being able to fly without any visible means of propulsion or lift, but with respect to the superhero's many other powers, we are not kidding. Cyborgs, also known as bionic people, have been among us for some time. A heart patient with a pacemaker implant, a Parkinson's patient with a deep brain stimulator implant, a paraplegic patient fitted with a C leg, that's C with a capital C, a prosthetic leg made by Otto Beck in Germany. These and many more are machine-enhanced human beings. They are cyborgs. They are bionic people. Most bionic devices need to be activated and deactivated automatically for fairly obvious reasons. You don't want to start searching for the on switch on a box in your pocket or on your belt after your heart starts fibrillating out of control, or after your Parkinson's hands start twitching uncontrollably, or after your epileptic seizure has left you writhing on the floor, or as your C leg stays rooted to the spot when you try to get out of the way of an approaching car. That means bionic devices need to receive, understand, and respond appropriately and automatically to signals the nervous system sends out to the appropriate but missing or disabled muscles. That, in turn, means there has to be an interface, a connection, or usually a whole set of connections between the nervous system and the bionic device. Such interfaces have come to be known generically as the brain-machine interface, or BMI. BMI devices come in two types, one with the interface wired into the brain itself, and one interfacing wirelessly through sensors placed on the scalp. The direct wired interface is obviously invasive. It requires opening up the skull. It is therefore risky and expensive, but it captures and produces higher quality signals than the wireless interface. A wired BMI consisting of implanted electrodes has been available for some time to monitor seizures in epilepsy patients. Recently, that technology was adapted to enable two patients to type letters on a screen by simply concentrating their thoughts on each letter in turn. This has been done before, using both wired devices and a wireless BMI, but the latest approach should provide a faster communication rate and be much better at reading complex brain signals. Similar technology, a brain implant designed to detect and block the onset of seizures, can significantly reduce the frequency of seizures in the 30 to 50% of epilepsy patients for whom medication does not work. Regulatory approval for this device, called the responsive neurostimulator, is to be sought this year. It joins a handful of similar electrical stimulation devices approved or in development for epilepsy patients. But unlike those other devices, which stimulate the nervous system continuously or in a predetermined pattern, the responsive neurostimulator only fires when it detects abnormal electrical activity signaling the onset of a seizure. In a trial of nearly 200 patients, the device reduced the frequency of seizures by 29% on average, compared to a 14% reduction in patients given an inactive implant, a sort of placebo. Nearly half the active implant patients had their seizures reduced in frequency by more than 50%. Although this response is similar to that of some other devices already approved or in trial, the patients in the responsive neurostimulator trial had suffered especially severe epilepsy over many years. A third had tried vagus nerve stimulation, and another third had undergone surgery, all without success. Another wired BMI has enabled a patient with locked-in syndrome, which in this case resulted from a stroke, to communicate. The patient's cognitive abilities were intact, but he was paralyzed except for some movement of the eyes. His BMI implant, essentially an electrode and an FM transmitter, was installed 5 years ago near the boundary between the speech-related premotor and primary motor cortex. Neurites have since grown into the electrode. Their signals are amplified and transmitted by the implant to an antenna temporarily glued to the patient's head. The implanted electrode is powered by induction from a power coil also attached to the head. A laptop computer system translates the received neural systems that were basically intended for the vocal cords and converts them to sounds as quickly as a non-paralyzed person would be able to say them. Although so far, it has to be admitted, only 3 vowel sounds have been tested. After 25 sessions over a 5-month period, the vowels were correctly reproduced 89% of the time. The next version of the system will produce consonants and the rest of the vowels and will record 10 times as many neurons. The system has the potential eventually to enable real-time conversation and thereby minimize what I imagine to be the terrible social isolation that accompanies profound paralysis. For patients who lack not just control of a limb, but the limb itself, there are ways to interface the brain through the nervous system with a robotic prosthetic limb. To give you some sense for what is involved, let me briefly describe one new method for doing so in 8 steps. 1. Harvest cells from healthy muscle in the patient's body. 2. Place the cells on a scaffold on the inside of a microscopic cup made from an electrically conductive polymer, in other words, a plastic that can conduct electricity. 3. Position the cup on the ends of a motor nerve at the point where the limb was severed. And 4. Do the same for a sensory nerve. 5. Wait for the muscle cells to proliferate in the cups and for the nerve endings to grow into the cups and attach to the muscle cells. 6. Do this for as many nerve endings as possible. The more, the better. 7. Take the electrical signals coming from the motor neurons into the muscle and passing through the electroactive plastic and broadcast those signals to a computer controlling a robotic prosthetic limb attached to the patient. And finally, install heat sensors, pressure sensors, and any other sensors you like onto the prosthetic limb's fingers and send signals the other way via the sensory neurons to inform the patient's brain that the prosthetic is touching something hot or cold or hard or soft and so on. Most of this has already been done in rats with a severed peripheral nerve using, in this research, just 2 cups, with one with a motor neuron and one with a sensory neuron attached to them. Again, this particular research project is still in its early stages, but something approaching this fine level of interface presumably must have already been used to build a state-of-the-art prosthetic hand called the Smart Hand, all one word. Developed by a multinational team in the European Union, this artificial hand has been successfully wired to existing nerve endings in the stump of a Swedish patient's severed arm. It looks like a real hand, and it functions like a real hand, and it is as sensitive, or almost as sensitive, as a real hand. The patient is able not only to complete fairly complicated tasks, such as eating and writing, but he can even feel his artificial fingers. Here's what he told a television interviewer. "I am using muscles which I haven't used for years. I grab something hard and then I can feel it in the fingertips, which is strange as I don't have them anymore. It's amazing." The smart hand has four electric motors and 40 touch sensors in its present incarnation. Future versions will have artificial skin containing many, many more sensors and providing even more tactile feedback. Where a limb is still attached but paralyzed as a result of spinal cord injury, for example, it has proved possible to rewire individual neurons to bypass damaged areas and connect directly to muscles in the paralyzed limb. This has been achieved in monkeys whose arms were temporarily paralyzed for the purpose, leaving them unable to use their wrists. Brain signals were rerouted around the blocked nerve pathway via a wire running between a randomly selected neuron in the motor cortex, a computer, an electric shock generator, and a muscle in the arm. Whenever the neuron fired above a certain rate, the computer would tell the generator to shock the arm muscle, causing the muscle to contract. The monkeys quickly learned to move their paralyzed wrists to play a video game. The researchers involved in this project were surprised to find that nearly every neuron they tested in the brain could be used to control this type of stimulation. Even neurons which were unrelated to the movement of the wrist before the nerve block could be brought under control and co-opted, they said. They also showed that a single neuron could work two different muscles. A high firing rate triggered the wrist to flex, while a low firing rate caused it to extend. Still, using more than just one neuron would be better. In similar research conducted elsewhere, a monkey was able to pick up a ball via a wired BMI implant known as a functional electrical stimulation, or FES, device. FES is already used in US FDA-approved implants that can restore hand function and bladder control to some paralyzed patients. One existing FES implant enables the patient to shrug a shoulder to cause his hand to grasp an object, although it cannot yet enable the patient to control the strength of the grasp. The FES implant in the monkey brain records signals from the motor cortex, which a computer then decodes into specific muscle movements in five flexor muscles in the arm, enabling the monkeys to grasp objects and move their wrists in different directions. In a test involving putting a ball into a hole, which the monkeys were able to do every time before their nerves were blocked, the paralyzed monkeys succeeded only about 10% of the time until the FES system was turned on, when the success rate rose to 77%. A similar system is already working in a human paralyzed patient who is now able to control a computer model of an arm, though not yet an actual prosthetic. Human trials of this system with an actual prosthetic are likely to begin within a year or two. The responsive neurostimulator we talked about earlier is the size of a small deck of cards, and a cavity has to be created inside the skull to make room for it. Obviously, that's a risky business. The large size of this device, we would hazard a guess, is probably due to its batteries, since implant chips themselves can be made very small. An experimental sensor platform called Neural Wisp fits multiple electronic components onto a circuit board currently just over 2 centimeters long, and the future version will put them all onto a single chip 1 by 2 millimeters in size. With reduced size comes reduced power consumption, which makes it feasible to draw power through induction wirelessly from a radio source up to a meter away, instead of from bulky batteries attached to the implant. So far, the device has only been tested in mice, getting signal and power from and to an implant centimeters deep in the human brain will no doubt be much more difficult than getting power a few millimeters into a moth, but nanotechnology will likely eventually solve that problem. The devices we've discussed so far have not been nanoscale devices, At best, they are MEMS devices. MEMS means micro-electromechanical systems. MEMS engineering was an early enabler of bionics, facilitating the development of complex devices only a few centimeters big, like the present neural wisp, or even millimeters in size, like the future neural wisp. MEMS devices are clearly functional and useful at a gross level within the human body, as the examples I've given so far show. But for the ultimate in utility and control, it is going to be necessary, certainly at the interface where we are talking about individual neurons with diameters measuring mere billionths of a meter, it will be necessary to move several orders of magnitude down to the nanoscale. The electrodes used in brain implants today typically record the electrical activity of masses of neurons per electrode. Yet, as long ago as 2006, Harvard engineers used nanowire transistors to measure electrical signals not just in a single neuron, but at 50 points within a single neuron. The same group has now developed a nanowire recording system and has used it to capture some of the most precise, high-quality electrical recordings ever made, in this case from heart cells. That system clearly has potential application in neural prostheses and other medical devices, and indeed the Harvard researchers have already begun to make recordings from neural tissue. Furthermore, they are working on nanowire devices that can simultaneously record electrical signals as well as hormone, neurotransmitter, and other chemical signals, which would give a more integrated picture of biological functions. Similar, and possibly connected, we don't know this, similar research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory has resulted in an experimental artificial neuron, and that's our term for it, not theirs. This artificial neuron is made of silicon nanowire transistors encased in a fatty acid membrane. Because that membrane contains ion channels and can therefore also respond to proteins and other biomolecules, electrodes connecting a prosthetic device with the nervous system could read chemical as well as electrical signals, thus providing finer and more natural control over the prosthetic. The first prototypes at Livermore have only one type of ion channel, which limits their function. The next generation, they say, will have more channels. The researchers will also begin testing the artificial neuron's interactions with living cells. Nanotechnology is also able to solve a problem with current medical devices, namely that their electronics have to be isolated from the body and they are built on a rigid silicon platform. The solution is nanoscale silicon circuits built on a thin film of silk. These are biocompatible, conformable to the shape of tissue, and are partially biodegradable. The silk dissolves over time, and the circuits left behind, being at nanoscale, are too thin to irritate tissue. Silicon LED light-emitting diode devices already under development could act as photonic tattoos, as it were, showing, for example, blood sugar readings. Or they could be used as arrays of conformable electrodes that could interface with the nervous system in awkward places. Such devices have apparently been implanted in animals with no adverse effects to the body or to the device's performance. The group undertaking this research is currently designing silk-based electrodes that could be wrapped around individual peripheral nerves to help control prostheses. The conformability of an array of silk electrodes would enable it to be used in otherwise inaccessible crevices deep inside the brain. What are the implications of all of this? our ability to interface at the neural level and increasingly at the individual neuron level with computers and robotic machines is accelerating. While this has obvious implications for healthcare in the sense of being able to offer treatment for people with disabilities, it has longer-term, deeper implications because it promises to enhance the cognitive and motor capacities of perfectly healthy and able-bodied people as well. It is the dawn of the age of Superman and Superwoman. We kid you not. Thank you for listening, and remember that my associate editor Julian Bond and I digest so you don't have to. We'd be delighted to hear from you. You can find our email or post a comment on our website at hfd.dmc.org.